Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So I'm here at Subang Sudama?
Sarabang
Sudama. Okay. And I'm told there's about 100-ish people or so?
They'll be all in the six floor here.
Okay, okay. All right. So thank you so much for inviting me to come speak today. So today is Vaisak, and today we celebrate the birth, the life, or really the enlightenment of the Buddha. That was his big achievement, and his death. And so when he died, he attained parinibbana. And there's a Buddhist phrase which I'm pretty sure most of you have heard, which goes, one of the sayings of the Buddha is, whoever sees Nibbana sees the Buddha, and whoever sees the Buddha sees Nibbana. So he kind of made this, not just a comparison really, but they're like equivalent. One of the interesting things about being a Westerner monk, I'm from Canada, a lot of the fellow Westerner monks I meet, when we talk about Buddhism, we tend to want to talk about Nibbana. We want to talk about meditation. We want to talk about, how do we get there? How do we get to Nibbana? What we don't talk much about is the Buddha. And then talk to the non-Westerner monks, let's say the Sri Lankan monks, the Thai monks, the Malaysian monks, the more traditional, non-Westerner monks, what they tend to want to talk about is the Buddha, or maybe who some famous monks are, who are their favorite monks to learn meditation from. And it's more so a focus on who, whether that's the Buddha or some famous monk. It's an orientation towards, who's the leader. And that is a cultural thing. That is a cultural thing. I'm not saying that one way is better than the other. Because remember, if you see Nibbana, you see the Buddha. And if you see the Buddha, you see Nibbana. So they are equivalent. And we have the choice of, which of those two attracts us more to focus on. A little bit earlier, this banner was brought out, a checklist, and at the bottom, it's okay, brother. I'm just going to read the thing at the bottom, the last thing on the checklist here. Read a book on Buddhism and share my understanding with family and friends. I'm so happy you put that on your list. So today's Vaisak, and it is about the Buddha. If I were to recommend just one book to you about the Buddha, the title is called The Life of the Buddha. And it was written by Bhikkhu Nyanamoli. Bhikkhu Nyanamoli. So he's passed away now, but he was a Westerner monk. And he was the teacher, he was the Pali teacher of Bhikkhu Bodhi. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is the translator who made arguably the best translations of the English early Buddhist texts, like the Pali Canon. So this Life of the Buddha, it's there's a PDF of it. When my talk's over, I found it on the internet. I'm going to I'll share it over to brother Dr. Usui Kun if he wants to put it in your WhatsApp group or whatever. To my understanding, if you read it for self-study purposes, if you have in mind, I will read this for self-study, that falls under your fair usage in copyright law in Malaysia. Not to be confused with copyright infringement. Okay? You just have to remember the magical phrase in your mind. I'm reading this for self-study, so this is fair usage. Okay? So what that book is so this Bhikkhu Nyanamoli, he was one of the early Westerner monks who took a big interest in not just the Pali Canon in the Theravada, in Theravada Buddhism, but the early Buddhist texts, which is to say, the oldest portion of the Pali Canon, which we can attribute to the historical Buddha, comes from the time of the Buddha. It's not part of the commentarial Pali Canon, which came many hundreds of years later. So this book, Life of the Buddha, this Bhante Nyanamoli, he pulls together suttas from only the early Buddhist texts to try to recreate kind of like a timeline of the Buddha's life from birth to death, the best he can. Okay? So it's like, what kind of a story can we make out of the Buddha's life? Only drawing upon the early Buddhist texts. So this book, it's about 400 pages. And, it's maybe 2 centimeters thick if you actually had it in your hand. And the suttas that he brought together, they're sprinkled all over the place in the early Buddhist texts. They're not in order. So he it took him quite a lot of effort to put it all in order and kind of make a life story. So to my mind, if there was one book which is the best book to mention on a Vaisak, that's, I think, the best one. And of course, his attainment of Nibbana is his highest achievement. And really, that's what the whole religion of Buddhism is about. Can the monks and nuns become arahants or get as close as they can to arahantship? That's really the focus of the whole religion. Now, I've learned that later on today, there's going to be a couple of psychologists coming, and you're going to have a kind of a forum around, what can be done for the most healthy community, healthy teens, healthy psychology. Although Buddhism has a lot to say about morality, a lot to say about sila, and if we want to attain Nibbana, we must have good sila, even great sila. How can I put this? Psychology is only about 150 years old, 100 years old. Buddhism is about 2,600 years old. The Buddha was not a psychologist. He could help you attain Nibbana. That was his specialty. Psychologists, even though they are great people, they can't help you attain Nibbana. But they do specialize in mental health. And I must say, psychology's got a lot of really good terminology that I wish was in the Pali Canon. They got terms for a lot of things. They put names to things. Some of those terms are really, really good. So psychology is great at diagnosing. It's great at analyzing. Buddhism has a lot to say about morality. Pretty much everything you could possibly hope to be in there is in there. The terminology wasn't as well developed as the psychologists have today. So I think there's some complementary goodness between Buddhism and psychology that way. Historically, Buddhist monks like me, teaching a group of lay people like you, usually the monks would teach from the Jatakas, which are a commentarial portion of the Pali Canon. And in there is a lot of, you might say, like folk wisdom. It's almost like folk tales. But they have a moral lesson. They have, you know, a lot of helpful advice in there. I wish I had time today to read to you the first Jataka. I only have half an hour. Not enough time to read the whole thing. But I can summarize it real fast. There are two groups of traveling merchants who make a trip through a dangerous desert. And there's kind of like this monster in the desert who can disguise himself as a human being. And the monster is able to fool the first group of merchants. He fools them so badly that they trust him. He looks like a trustworthy human, but he isn't. And then he, in the middle of the night, kills them all and eats them. Then the second group of merchants comes. But the leader of that group is more wise. And he is able to pick up on some very subtle clues that this monster is, who looks like a human, isn't really trustworthy. So this second group of merchants, they don't let their guard down. The monster doesn't kill them, eat them, steal everything, you know. So the moral of the story is, you know, be careful who you trust. Sometimes people can look trustworthy at first and then they're not later. They turn out to be a monster, okay? So most cultures are going to have a story like this, okay? Most cultures have some folk tale about, you know, a monster who pretends to be a good person. Watch out. Like when I was growing up, every child was read a story by their parents called Hansel and Gretel. I don't know if you ever heard the story of Hansel and Gretel. Yeah? Okay. Yeah, it's a German folk tale, but similar thing. There's two young kids who get lost in the forest. They come to a gingerbread house, and there's candy stuck to the outside of this house, so they start... They're little kids, so they're not very smart. So they start eating the candy. And then this old lady comes out and invites the children inside the house. And now, you know, all of us know, come on, there's no gingerbread house in the forest with candy on it. Something's got to be wrong here, you know. when you're an adult, it occurs to you that, like, this is too good to be true, you know? Just a house made of gingerbread that I get to just take the candy right off and eat it for free? You know, we have this phrase, too good to be true. Too good to be true. Okay? Anyway, so Hansel and Gretel go in the house. They're not very smart because they're young kids. And it turns out this old lady is this evil, wicked witch, and she wants to throw those kids in a stew pot and boil them and eat them. And so they manage to barely escape. Okay, so this story, you know, we can see stories like this over and over again, okay? Different cultures. And of course, it's the job of the parents to teach their children, you know, watch out, there's evil people in this world. You can't just trust everyone. Even if they offer you candy for free or whatever it is, they offer you something nice for free. You know, it's probably too good to be true. Maybe your grandparents will offer you candy. You can trust them, you know. But just some stranger you never met before, just offering you free candy, probably not a good idea, okay? And there's this one similar folk tale. It comes from African culture, from around the Somalia area. And in this version of the story, there's a family of desert nomads. Okay, so it's a family who walks around in the desert looking for, whatever they can eat, and they're looking to settle down in some place where it's, you know, nice grass is growing and there's water, and the idea is to become to have livestock, like. To be kind of ranchers of livestock. And now the very first green field they come to, the very first one has a house. So they go up to the house, and there's this nice man there, and the nice man invites them to stay, and the nice man invites them to even live there for free and everything. And like, oh, it's such a good deal. And they decide to live there. And however, the wife thinks there's got to be something wrong here. But the husband doesn't see any problem. So the wife just sort of listens to the husband, thinking, well, okay, even though I think something's wrong here, the man's in charge, so I'll just say nothing. And the baby cries. The baby's scared of this man. The baby is definitely not happy about it. Anyway, but the man ignores this. And then later on, this is after staying there months and months and months. Later on, a monster comes in the night and steals the baby away and eats it. And when they go to tell that man of the house about the monster, he's missing. And then later on, then that man reappears. You know, the next day, that man reappears. He's got a little bit of meat stuck in his teeth. He's got a little bit of meat stuck between his teeth. And the wife notices this. But again, that husband is pretty unwise. He doesn't notice this. He doesn't think anything of it. Anyway, they foolishly continue to live there because it's free. And the wife gets pregnant again, has another baby. And once that baby's born, again, in the middle of the night, a monster comes. And now this time, while the monster's eating the baby, the husband catches the monster And the monster is that man of the house. Is that man of the house. Yeah. So the man and the wife can't defeat the monster, but they run away. They run away. So they lost two children. They lost two children. And the moral of the story is they shouldn't have settled down at the very first opportunity they came across. That green pasture that they first found, that was the very first green pasture. They didn't go searching around to find some other pasture, maybe with no house on it, and built their own house. No. They took up the very first offer they received. And it turned out to be a really bad offer, okay? They didn't look enough. And another moral of the story is some people maybe aren't all that great at seeing hints that somebody's evil, but others are good at it, okay? Remember early on in the story, the first baby cried immediately. That was a big hint. And the wife, she didn't feel comfortable. She knew something was wrong. And they ignored that. They ignored the signs. But the husband was, he was overconfident. Okay, so too much confidence can really be a bad thing. When we should notice the signs. So yeah, when you talk to those psychologists later, you can ask them questions like, you know, what sort of signs should we be looking for if there's a problem, you know? Yeah. Psychologists are fantastic at finding all sorts of patterns in behavior, patterns in relationships. You know, what are some indicators? What are some signs? Maybe that somebody's not trustworthy, or a sign of a relationship not being healthy. Oftentimes, relationships can actually go quite well for quite a long time, many months, maybe even a year or two. And then some big problem happens that we perhaps could have seen earlier if we would have known the signs. Sometimes evil people can hide their evil for a long time, okay? So that's why I told you this story about the monster in the desert, where the villain of the story, he hides his evil for a long time. Long enough, you know, that he got two of their babies. You know, it takes quite a long time to have a baby, as you know. He fooled them for that long. Those are the trickiest ones. When really evil people hide it for a long time, like years, a couple years. There is an interesting sutta where the Buddha meets with a king. And the king asks the Buddha if he can identify an arahant when he sees one. And some holy men walked by a little ways away. Some holy men. They weren't Buddhist monks, but in India there's all these sadhus everywhere, other holy men. So the king is like, so those sadhus who went by, can you tell if those were arahants? And the Buddha gives an interesting answer. He says, before deciding if somebody's an arahant, he needs to observe their behavior over a long period of time, as much as a couple of years. And he needs to see how they act in a number of times and situations. What are they like, you know, in front of a crowd of people? What are they like privately? You know, what are they like around their friends? Or what about if they're around strangers? Or maybe people who they don't need to be nice to? By the way, I got a little tip that I learned from psychology to share. That's one of the easiest ways to know somebody's true character. How do they behave towards people when they don't need to be nice to them? If there's somebody who has like a really lowly job and you can just be as rude as you want to that person because you're never going to see them again. You know, in 20 minutes, half an hour, they're going to be gone from your life. You can get away with being rude to them if you want. If somebody takes the opportunity to be rude, they can get away with it. That is a true moment of seeing their character. Like, what do they do when they can get away with it? Yeah. So that's interesting. The Buddha, you know, he had all these psychic powers, right? He could attain all these jhanas. He could levitate in the air and fly. He had all kinds of psychic powers. But here's a rare occasion. Here's a rare occasion where he's admitting he has to get to know somebody's character for a long time, as long as a year or two, before he can really build up trust and conclude they're an arhant. He needs to see their morality. He needs to see their sila. Even if some monk or nun can achieve really deep meditation, maybe samadhi, the jhanas, which is awesome. But what remains to be seen is, but what's their morality going to still be like later on? Let's say a week later, a month later. So it's kind of a rare moment where it's, I guess, a lesson for us about human nature, human character. Yeah. Okay, so I thought I'd share that just because I heard you're going to have this meeting later on. Yeah, so I'm going to share this link around to this book if you... And I would encourage you to read it. The Life of the Buddha is the title. And now, who can speak and read English? Who can speak and read English? Okay. So maybe half the room. Okay, now in this book, The Life of the Buddha, after every sutta... the sutta reference is there, okay? So after the first sutta, it says like MN 123, okay? So that's Majjhima Nikaya Sutta 123. You could get the Chinese translation of it at the website Sutta Central. I'll send maybe a link as well. There's such good resources on the internet for this now. Like, there's a site where you just have to punch in MN space 123, and then it will take you to that sutta at suttacentral.net. And it'll show you the English at first, but then you can change it to Chinese. So for every sutta in this book, you could just go to Sutta Central, change the language to Chinese, and you could still read all those same suttas in Chinese. Yeah, so those references at the end are really valuable. You know, the MN123, and it's a fairly recent development that we can do these sutta lookups really easily. As long as you know the reference, like, you know, we can quickly look up the sutta, change the language. Yeah, it's so convenient now. Yeah, so I'm also going to send a link just about that first sutta, MN123, just to show you. I'll show Brother Dr. Usui-kun. You know, so even if you can't read English, with a little research, you can go read the Mandarin too. Okay, so maybe I'll just conclude there.